You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, November 7th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, I'm exhausted. Breaking news. President Obama won last night. On the program today, Ari Berman will be with us to talk about, give us a roundup of all the voter suppression and his reflections on the win last night. Also on the program, David Dayan, to dig deeper into some of the big referendum moves, particularly in California. We all know what happens in California makes its way east across the country. Roller skates, inline skating, skateboards, anything that involves wheels tends to come east, in my experience. And so this is rather important. That horrible tax cut that Ronald Reagan instituted was a Proposition 13 out there, or Proposition 3, and then came to Massachusetts as either Prop 3 or Prop 13. I remember that because that was the day that basically everything in our school was shut down following that tax cut back in the day in Massachusetts. A really stunning night. I was, I guess, a little too conservative in my predictions. Although Florida's not in, but there is real strong reason to believe that Florida is going to go in President Obama's column. Winning with 332 electoral votes. What is that? Romney got like 219, is that what it is? Or less?
206.
206. That's a rather large disparity in votes. And now at this point, as far as I can tell, the popular vote is about a 2% spread. However, I will virtually guarantee you folks that within a couple of weeks, it will be at least 3%. As I predicted, California, there's like a million votes. I said a 3% spread. No, I didn't say 5. No, 51 and change to 47 and change. Maybe not. Maybe that's a 4. I don't know. You're going to have to check. You screwed up. I said at least 3. Let me put it that way. I can't remember. I told Ari Berman I said at least 3. So that's basically what it's at. But we are not here to boast about my prediction. We are here to gloat and shove it in the faces of conservatives, because that was the most fun that I had last night, was to watch the incredible meltdown on Fox and the stunning disbelief. I mean, look, Brit Hume last night. Now, most of you know, I generally do not care what the right has to say, although there are times when it's fun. But last night, Brit Hume was looking at the numbers and said, we've got 20-some-odd percent coming out of the polls, exit polls, identify as liberals, and 30%, 35% as conservatives, but 40% as moderates. And we have to now concede to ourselves that a lot of those moderates are actually liberals. They actually believe in liberal ideas. Now, the right was successful in making liberalism a dirty word. And I don't know if their definition of liberalism is where I would like it to be. But the fact of the matter is that there, dawn is rising on Marblehead. And a lot of these Peggy Noonanites, the Brit Humes, even Dick Morris. Let me read you what Dick Morris said after his, after he dislodged the toes from his mouth, the mouth, his foot from his mouth, from someone else's toes from his mouth.
I think the reason the prediction I made was wrong is that I was criticizing the polling because I said it reflected the same turnout model there was in 2008.
I think, folks, I'm fairly convinced at one point on this program I said this was about turnout models, no? About likely voters. And I said I thought it was a one-off affair, that it would not continue, et cetera, et cetera. What this is saying is this is the new America. This isn't your father's America. Now, what is Dick Morris saying when he says this isn't your father's America? Well, first of all, who's he speaking to? Because he's clearly not speaking to anybody who is brown in any way. Because guess what? It was the father's America then. What he's saying is that the demographics have shifted. And your father's America, where your father was the king of the house and of basically our economy and any opportunity that existed, et cetera, et cetera. That was the real America. Now we're seeing the ascendancy of the fake, artificial, wrong America. The percentage of single women, minorities, and voters under 30 is so large at this point that unless the Republican Party fundamentally changes its appeal to those voters, it can never win an election. That was what Brit Hume was saying. That's what Peggy Noonan was saying. You're going to hear a lot. That's what Lindsey Graham was saying all during this. Please. That's what Lindsey Graham was saying all during the past couple of weeks. The Republican Party has to change. It has to shift. Dick Morris, in the only legitimate thing that I think this has come out of his mouth, aside from those toes in recent memory, is this. If this candidate in this economy against this opponent can't win an election with this electorate, nobody ever can. And what the Republican Party needs to do is stop running in the face of those demographics and start appealing to them and start revising some of its priorities and its positions in order to reach that vote, because that vote is here to stay. So what is Dick Morris saying, but doesn't have the brass ones to say on Fox in an explicit manner? This is just a dog whistle to the people who already know this. What he's saying is that the Republican Party can no longer be the party of we hate brown people. The Republican Party can no longer be the party of you can't get pregnant if you're raped. You shouldn't have complete access to birth control in the way that guys can get access to Viagra. That's basically what he's saying. We can't perceive women as just either, you know, a good choice that we make as to we pick them to be the lady who sits in the kitchen and makes dinner for everybody. That's what he's saying. The problem the Republicans have, and why I've been saying since 2008, well, and maybe even earlier, that they cannot win a national election for president, is because they have created a Frankenstein. And that Frankenstein is their fundamentalist electorate and their racist electorate. Their electoral base is so bathed in racism and religious fundamentalism that now you've got Frankenstein running through the streets and Dr. Frankenstein can't rope this monster in. It's just not possible. And the reason why they're not going to be able to rope this monster in is because there is too much of an infrastructure that actually benefits more from their lunacy on the right than they would if they were actually to win a national election. And I'm not talking about the wealthy establishment supporters of the Republican Party, because frankly, they also now are patronizing the Democratic Party. I am talking about everybody from Rush Limbaugh to every other semi-local politician, Congress people, maybe in some parts of the South, senators, who simply benefit from the fact that their base are completely insane. And their incentives are misaligned with any incentives that the Republican Party could have to win in a national election. So we're going to continue to see this. It's quite possible. I mean, it's quite possible, I guess, something happens down the road that tears that party apart. But we're going to see this is going to be a continued evolution to where they're just not going to play on the national stage. And you can see this demographic trend. I read this book, I guess, I don't know, 15 years ago, maybe it was. Roy Texera and John Judas, I think it was, about the emerging Democratic majority. I think it was Tom Schaller wrote this book, Whistling Past Dixie. This is all coming to fruition. And it leaves us with the battle that we're going to be fighting in the future, which is the one that, to a certain extent, this revamped show started nearly 2 years ago to the day, talking about, was that the real battle lines, at least in terms of national politics, are between 99% of us and the 1%, the rich, their policy choices being implemented regardless of who is in power. And that is going to be the fight that we wage going forward. And by all means, to the extent that we can now exploit what the Republicans and the right exploited for the past 20 years, that being their racism and their religious fundamentalism, now it's our turn to exploit their racism and their religious fundamentalism to our electoral benefit. And that's what this election shows. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ari Berman. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is Ari Berman live from Washington, D.C. Ari, are you exhausted?
Exhausted doesn't even begin to capture how I feel. But I am. It's a relieved exhaustion, at least, not a despairing exhaustion.
Indeed, yeah. This would be a rough day if, for some reason, seventy electoral votes went the other direction. This is a pretty massive win, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a really massive win. And Sam, the prophet that you are, you confidently predicted it from day one. I was a little less sure. And having reported on voter suppression for about a year and a half, I thought there was definitely the potential for one or more recounts here. And I thought there was a good chance that it would come down to the provisional ballots in places like Ohio and Florida, and that we wouldn't know the election results for quite a long time. I'm glad that didn't happen. It would have been a good story for me to cover, but I'm glad it didn't happen. And hopefully tomorrow we can go back to normal and we can start talking about actually governing this country instead of campaigning for 2 years.
Now, let me tell you right now, because I want to talk, I want to talk about just your thoughts on the general election, but I want to focus because you've been covering this voter suppression beat as well as anybody in the country. And I think, frankly, also your reporting, that piece you did in the Rolling Stone, I think really mobilized people, because this could have, many of these voter suppression tactics could have easily gone the other way. But there was a full court press by, many, many groups out there that got a lot of these decisions reversed in time. But right now, I am looking at a photo taken of Fox News where the host is talking to a reporter. I don't know where that reporter is. And the lower third has voter fraud at foxnews.com. They're obviously looking for reports of voter fraud, and they have set up an entire email just to get all of those that are rushing in. Give us just a broad overview of why you thought that, give us just a sort of like, I guess, a broad overview of the timeline of what happened. You know, it's hard to generalize it, but I know that we had 10 to 12 states that, following the takeover by Republicans in 2010 of these state legislatures, which also, we should add, contributed to the Republicans retaining the House because they also redistricted.
Yeah.
And that's one measure of how they tried to suppress and disenfranchise particularly minority voters. You wrote quite a bit on that as well. But then there was this basically this pushback, mostly through the legal system, partly through the Department of Justice.
Yeah, so there was really two big changes that resulted from Republicans controlling state legislatures after the 2010 election. One was that they were able to draw their own legislative districts, and they were able to basically secure a lot of their legislative members. And the only reason that Republicans held the House last night was because they gerrymandered so many seats to put themselves in safe districts and to win. So they succeeded on that front, and they could control these seats for the next decade until the next census comes out. But the other thing they did was, in more than a dozen states, they changed the election laws in one way or another to restrict the right to vote.
Hold on for 1 second, because I want to just make sure that we are clear on this. I know we've talked about it on this program before, but not only did they secure their seats in terms of gerrymandering their districts, which has happened, certainly happens in the past, but never maybe with this sort of this robust of an effort. But what they also did was they did it by essentially corralling minority voters into specific districts. Right? I mean, it wasn't just
what they did, particularly in the South, was they took integrated districts and they turned them into overwhelmingly black districts or overwhelmingly white districts as a way to basically corral as many Democratic minority voters as possible into as few of districts as possible. And so that's how they were able to hold or gain seats in states like North Carolina. And I thought that was so distressing because it's not just a political issue, it's a civil rights issue. I mean, you are taking integrated districts that are in many ways a signal of the progress that we've made in America, and you're taking us back to a day when there were no integrated districts in the South. And that's not only what happened through redistricting, that's what happened through voting as well. I mean, it was very clear what the GOP was trying to do when they changed the voting laws, either through making it harder to register to vote, cutting back on early voting, requiring voter ID laws, was to make it harder for this growing coalition of voters in America, young people, blacks, Hispanics, to be able to cast a ballot. Now, I think that strategy backfired on them, and I think it backfired for two reasons. Number one, a lot of these laws were overturned, and they were overturned because there was a massive pushback through the courts to block these laws, and there was a lot of great work done by civil rights groups to get the evidence before judges to say these laws are discriminatory. The second thing is that they motivated particularly immigrant communities and historically disenfranchised communities, particularly the black vote, to turn out. I was in Cleveland the weekend before the election. I was spending a lot of time in black churches, and you heard over and over and over, they're trying to take away our vote. And people may have been disappointed with Barack Obama, but when you try to take away their voting rights, they're going to vote. And I think you saw the huge turnout among black voters for Obama, and I think the GOP's suppression strategy motivated more people to get out there and to exercise that constitutional right and to protect it going forward.
And like you say, there was, and I've got the breakdown. The Democrats picked up a couple of state legislators last night. Some of these voting rights may be restored statutorily, I guess. That remains to be seen. I don't know that, down in the South, those things are going to come back. And certainly, like you say, the redistricting only happens every 10 years. All in all, I think, to a certain extent, many of these things were pushed back. And I think it also, I think you're right about it creating this greater appreciation for the right to vote.
Think about how much time we spent talking about the right to vote in the past 2 years. I mean, people had to go through an incredible number of hurdles to be able to vote in certain cases, but the fact that we had that conversation, I think, made a lot of people think more about voting, think more about how we vote. And I do think that Republicans are really face a tough choice right now. They can either continue with the suppression strategy and risk alienating the fastest growing segments of the electorate, or they can try to court an increasingly diverse electorate by changing their policy positions on things like immigration reform. If they don't change their policy positions, and I think it's going to be very difficult for them to do so given the Tea Party base of the party, which determines who wins primaries and who is nominated, I think they're going to have to continue with the suppression strategy, but I don't think it's going to be a popular one because everyone saw those lines in Florida, and that pissed people off. They're like, why is this happening again in 2012? They knew it was deliberate. They knew that Republicans shortened the early voting periods. This was the result. And so anytime you're going to make voting inconvenient, it's going to be unpopular. The other big thing was in Minnesota, a voter ID ballot initiative was defeated. It's the first time a voter ID ballot initiative has been defeated. Granted, it's Minnesota, but still, Minnesota was something of a swing state. It's not the bluest state in the country. And so that tells me that at least among Democrats and some independents, they're realizing what voter ID is. They're realizing it's not about stopping voter fraud. In-person voter fraud doesn't exist. It's about shaping an electorate to Republicans' favor. And the fact that that went down is going to make it harder for Republicans to pass these laws in other purple states going forward.
So, first off, I think you're absolutely right about that voter suppression. In fact, I opened the show today with basically talking about that dynamic. You hear the Peggy Noonans, even Dick Morris, Britt Hume saying basically you're saying that the Republican Party has to change its hostility to certain voting groups. Otherwise, you just can't compete on a national level. And I agree with your assessment. There's no way they can do it. They are trapped in essentially what, is the equivalent of an insurance pool death spiral. They just they can't do it. They have simply they have banked on certain things. They have built an infrastructure, cottage industries around these mentalities, and there is too much misaligned incentives for them to be able to make this turn. And I think it's going to continue to isolate them, and I think they're going to continue to do these voter suppression because it's going to be the only option for them, and I think it's going to continue to blow back. But here's
can I say one other thing about this?
Go ahead.
I think Democrats need to get serious about expanding the right to vote. Now that they're in positions of power, they need to do something about this. California passed online and same-day voter registration. That's huge. We need to do that everywhere. There's no reason that if you are a Democrat, and I would hope Republicans would adopt this too, although I'm not holding my breath, if you're a state legislature in one of these places in the majority, if you're a governor, if you're a member of the Senate, you should be right away, first day of the session, promoting a bill for same-day registration in your state. You should be promoting online registration. You should be promoting early voting. The only way long-term to counter the suppression strategy is to have a strategy that expands the right to vote. And we have 50 million people in this country who aren't registered to vote. We had untold numbers of people in this country who showed up and told they weren't registered to vote and had to cast provisional ballots or couldn't wait in line for 7 hours or didn't have the right ID to be able to vote in places like Kansas and Tennessee where voter ID laws are now on the books and weren't blocked in court. And so I'd like to see politicians of both parties get a lot more serious about election reform now.
And people have to understand, this has to happen on the state level because there is no federal mechanism in which to – there is no – I mean, this is the thing that I think people don't really fully grasp because it in some ways it's completely astonishing. But even for federal elections, like the president, like Congress, like the Senate, there is no federal statutory regime to normalize the voting procedures across the country.
No, I mean, there's different laws that have been passed, like the Help America Vote Act, that have standardized some portions of American election law, but there's no doubt that election law varies state by state by state. We have partisan election officials in charge of running our elections, which is an inherent conflict of interest. We have a situation now where the GOP is challenging Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which applies to parts or all of 16 states, saying they need to get approval from the federal government. Instead of challenging Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and overturning it, I would like to see every state subject to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, so that if states try to enact discriminatory voting laws, the federal government has some mechanism to stop it, which they don't have right now in 34 different states. But Section 5 is crucially important. This is the next battle in voting rights. We don't know when the Supreme Court's going to take this case, but likely it'll be heard next spring. And I think all the evidence that we saw this year of Republicans trying to suppress the vote should be used in court to show why we still need the protections of the Voting Rights Act.
So, all right. So, you know, that's my biggest hope is that, you know, it just seems like voter suppression only comes up, obviously, you know, in the months before the election, because then it's in front of our face and then everybody forgets about it and then it comes up again. And it's been happening since, well, at least, you know, in my consciousness since 2000, right? I mean, we've had six elections since then, and it seems to happen almost every time. This year was a little bit more dramatic, I think, because of the Republicans were more aggressive about it because, like you say, it's their last vestige. So hopefully this can be an issue. You know, they say the best time to get a lawyer is when you don't need one. The best time to do these type of expanding the right to vote and the access to a ballot, essentially, is when you're as far away from an election as possible.
Well, and I think this time the laws passed were worse, but the pushback was greater. 2000 really caught everyone by surprise. 2004 was just so chaotic. There was so much stuff going on that no one really knew what was going to happen on Election Day. And quite frankly, no one was really prepared for what happened in Ohio in 2004 with those just incredibly long lines. 2008 went relatively smoothly, and I think because it went smoothly, Republicans decided that they needed to do something additional to ensure that they would win. And then so what we saw in 2012 was a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion. But I think the fact that people were so alert to what was going to happen mitigated some of these problems. There's no doubt that some people were disenfranchised. We don't know yet how many people were turned away because they didn't have the right ID, or how many people couldn't wait online for 7 hours, or how many people were forced to cast provisional ballots that were not ultimately counted. I mean, we're going to know this kind of stuff in the coming weeks as we get the reports from different states. But there's no doubt that, you know, I was in the thick yesterday in the war room of the Election Protection Coalition, which runs the 866-R-VOTE hotline, and the reports coming in there were incredibly alarming. But the good news was that there was a lot of people on the ground to deal with this. There was a lot of people talking about it and giving information to voters. And so I do think that we have to have the most dysfunctional election system of any advanced democracy. I mean, I just can't imagine any country doing it worse than we do it right now.
We have a lot of Canadian listeners on this program, and I can't tell you how many emails we got, like, or tweets I got from people going like, "What the frick is going on down there? Yeah, I've never heard of such a thing. I mean, you people are waiting in line for hours to vote. It's just absurd. It is absurd."
We have, in many ways, you know, a 19th century electoral system in the 21st century in this country.
I can't wait for Fox to come out and say, actually, long lines are good because it prevents people who are posing as other people from voting, because then they can't do it in such widespread ways.
Well, I mean, but you essentially had a situation where Republicans in Florida said, "I want voting to be hard. I don't want it to be easy." And the reason they said that is because, you know, affluent people don't live in neighborhoods where they have to wait for 7 hours. They have fully staffed voting places with short lines and lots of workers and functioning voting machines. People who are less affluent have less staff at their polling place. They have less resources. They have worse voting machines. They have to wait in longer lines. And so these lines target people who are working people who don't have the time or the ability to wait for 7 hours. And so the lines were a form of suppression, and the whole idea that voting should be difficult is a form of suppression. And I think that's just an idea that is really, really unpopular. I mean, I think there's probably a lot more support for election reform now than there was a few years ago.
Yeah, I think that's the case as well. All right, so I appreciate you giving me the time today, but just a couple of words on the presidential election. Were you surprised? And what do you think about the fact that the Democrats picked up two Senate seats? They picked up two Senate seats. I mean, if you include Sanders and Angus Khan, what's his name?
King.
Angus King.
He's Genghis is Kong, long lost brother, Angus,
who ran as an independent up in Maine. I'm sorry,
he could be the Joe Lieberman of the Senate. By the way, he seems like a real handful. I think the other story, and I didn't follow this as closely, but I'd like to hear more about it, is the money that was spent. I mean, the GOP got a terrible return on investment. I mean, Sheldon Adelson has to be about the dumbest person on the planet right now. How much money did he blow on Newt Gingrich and then Mitt Romney? Karl Rove.
Well, but to his credit, he did introduce the country to Bain and to the concept of vulture capitalism. So I basically want to send him a thank you.
That is true.
I want to send him a muffin
a
basket right
way.
Now.
The other thing is that Karl Rove basically snookered a ton of donors. He kept giving them inaccurate information about swing states. They poured a ton of money into races that they didn't win. I'm still very, very concerned about the impact of Citizens United on the electoral process. And again, I think this has to be one of the top priorities of Democrats, is to try to figure out a way to get rid or to at least mitigate this law. But the GOP did not get a good rate of return. The other thing I would just mention, Sam, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this going forward, is now that Democrats have retained their Senate majority, they need to get serious about filibuster reform, because nothing is going to be done in Washington if we have a 60-vote threshold in the Senate. So I think a lot of Democrats were afraid to do anything on filibuster reform after the 2010 election because they thought they were going to lose their majority. Now that they haven't lost the majority and they're probably not going to lose it barring some catastrophic thing happening next election cycle. I think it's time to basically say, if we want to get stuff done, if we don't want gridlock in Washington, I don't think anyone does want gridlock in Washington, we have to change the rules of the Senate, or else we're going to see the next 4 years be like the last two.
Harry Reid said, if I remember correctly, about 6 to 8 months ago, he said, I admit I was wrong on that. I think he
said he was wrong, and he needs to do something about it. Now is the time to do it. He has to start preparing people for changing the rules and explain why it's so important to do so.
Yeah, I think that's crucial. And I think your point about the money is well taken. I think there's going to be too much stories about how Citizens United money didn't make a difference, because it's going to imply that it's not going to make a difference in the future. Look, the first election cycle where you have this type of money, it is the perfect opportunity to squeeze, to essentially milk these teats. I've seen this in my experience in entrepreneurial businesses, where big money comes in, it's stupid money, and you've got the charlatans or the first guys through the door. They've got the shiny watches, the nice shoes, and they're able to suck as much money out of these people as possible. And the thing that people have to understand is that the reason why Rove and the like-minded people were applying this money poorly was because they were applying it in the most profitable way for them. And in other words, like, we're going to buy – like, I sat on my couch with my wife, and I don't know when it was, what we were watching, but we were watching – we saw ads. We saw national Romney ads. And I'm sitting in New York, and I said to my wife, I said, this is the biggest scam in the world. There is it was Saturday Night Live. We were watching Saturday Night Live because Louis was on this week. And I turned to her, and I go, this is the biggest scam in the world. And she's like, why? And because it's hitting all these other places in the country. But like, no, they should be targeting these ads in three states right now. And they should be spending every dollar that they spend. The yield should be the voters that count. And this is a scam, because he's getting bigger. He's getting a bigger markup on a national ad buy than he would on, Channel 14 in Columbus or whatever it is.
Yeah, well, the other thing I would say is we don't know the impact of big money in down ballot races. We don't know what impact it had in the House or what impact it had in judicial elections and all the way down the line. And those races really matter.
I agree.
The fact that, for example, the Koch brothers went after judges in North Carolina is a very big deal. And the other thing I would say is, just because Obama was reelected doesn't make the disturbing things that happened this election go away. I mean, this was a very, very, very disturbing election, from the voter suppression to the dark money to employers telling their employees who to vote for. I mean, a lot of really bad stuff happened, and I hope that doesn't set a precedent and basically make it as the new normal, that we're just going to get used to voter suppression laws and unlimited money and employers bossing their employees around. I mean, I really hope that is now standard practice for how we run American elections going forward.
Yeah, well, I agree. I am a little concerned that may be the case, though. All right, Ari Berman, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam, and congrats on another almost perfect Electoral College prediction.
Well, and frankly, also,
I'm sure you'll never hear you talk about it.
You're
going to
see my percentage. You're
going to
see my percentage is also right on the money too. Once those votes in California are counted.
All right, my friend.
I'm pretty sure we made a bet about it, but another one. But I'll go back and check the tape.
Okay, go review our email traffic.
All right, I'll talk to you later. Thank you.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break in just a minute, right? But let's first, should we try and do a random rush? I never do this on the main show. It's got to be happening right now.
During that interview, Michael sent me a message that apparently Rush Limbaugh opened up with, none of this makes any sense.
All right. Well, let's do a random rush. Hold on. Let me get my we generally do this during the better half of the program, but today it's just too good. We're going to have to do it. So for those of you who don't know, random rush is when I randomly turn on Rush Limbaugh through my app here, whatever it is, Wonder Radio. And I listen to Rush Limbaugh for 60 seconds, and I rebut him in 90 seconds. I know some of you don't like to hear from him, but sorry, folks. That's what we're going to do. And let's see if... okay, hold on. There he is. Okay, so here we go. I start now. Here it is. Random Rush.
But why don't the Marco Rubios, the Alan Wests? What a great man. What a great American. Alan West. What a great role model. Clarence Thomas. Herman Cain. None of it counts. Don't tell me the Republican Party doesn't have outreach. We do. But what are we supposed to do now? We're supposed to, in order, that mean open the borders and embrace the illegals. Is that what, no, I want you to think about this. Is that what it means? Is that what the Republican establishment, so we got to reach out to Hispanics? Is that what they mean? If we're not getting the female vote, do we become pro-choice? Do we start passing out birth control pills? Is that what we have to do? Okay, let me ask you, if that's what we have to do.
All right. Now in 90 seconds. Well, this is what I've been talking about since the opening remarks of this program today. This is why the Republican Party will never, ever, ever again, well, at least until maybe my kid, my seven-year-old is voting, win a national election. Because though you will get the Peggy Noonans, the Dick Morrises, the Britt Humes, the David Brooks, all of the Republican establishment types, all the non-Neanderthal, just money-grubbing Republican types, they may say, we've got to expand the party. We cannot overtly hate brown people. We cannot deny access to birth control to women. We cannot say that there's legitimate rape and illegitimate rape, and we can't continue to kowtow to these religious fundamentalists. They have created a Frankenstein, and Rush Limbaugh is one of the guys, the brain of the Frankenstein. There is just too much incentive on the right to let go of all that hatred, because that's how he makes his money. That's how he establishes his power, and that's how little congressmen, maybe in the South, they'll get reelected by continuing to be this crazy. So the Republican Party cannot return from where it came, from any type of moderation. It will continue this death spiral led by its intellectual pillar, Rush Limbaugh.
The names he threw out, my God.
That was fantastic.
Herman Cain.
Herman Cain. I didn't even have a chance to get to all those. Here's our group. We have three black people. We have three black people. Three black people. Herman Cain. Is no one taking him seriously anymore? He's the one who came up with 999.
That's two more than needed to be a token.
That's right. We don't just have one black guy. We've got three black guys. What are we supposed to do now? Hand out abortion pills?
Like fund education for kids?
Yeah. No, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm sorry. We could not have... That could not have fit into the theme of today's program any better. The Republican Party is just, they're in a death spiral. And which cuts both ways on some level for people who want to see real. I know, we may have to go back in. We may have to do another random rush in the second half of the program. All right, folks, we got to take a break because we're going to go to... David Dayan, who's going to tell us about what's happening in California. But where is my document now about – oh, here it is. We neglected to do this at the first break. You will remember a couple of weeks ago we featured some music by a listener of this program, and you'll remember he is the one who made Pottersville. after the Scott Walker thing, and it's an amazing song. The name of the band is Decomposure from Blank Squirrel Records. It's available on iTunes, Bandcamp. In fact, if you go to bandcamp.com, we have the link on the site. We'll put it up in the blog post today, but I think we also have the ad at the bottom of the page. You use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 20% off of Decomposure albums. So it's I don't know, $5 maybe for an album. But the music's on eMusic, Spotify, Amazon. It's great stuff. We should repost the videos too, because this guy from Decomposure is an amazing artist too. And so the videos are just as enjoyable as the music and amazing. One of them, the lead one, I think is really stunning, because you get to see how he made the art, the cover art.
And it's not even like good for like an independent artist. This guy is legit. He is like, it's professional. It's really good.
No,
this guy
it's really
should
good
be,
stuff.
This guy should be
and,
big.
All right, so we're going to go out. The rest of the music that we play and maybe if we can go back and replace that other song, all the music we play today will be from Decomposure, from Blank Squirrel Records. There's a link on the blog. Check it out. You could just Google Decomposure, Blank Squirrel Records. The album's title is Eating Chicken. And what is this cut?
This is How It Happened.
How It Happened. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dan. Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome the news editor for Fire Dog Lake. One of the, every time you come on, I have to say this because I'm constantly amazed at the amount of, not just the amount of work you produce, but also the quality. If I read something that you have written, I know it is true.
Wow, this is a great power you've bestowed on me, because I could literally write anything now.
Yes,
and you would believe it that way.
Indeed.
So I could mislead you so easily.
Yes, you could. You could. It's a huge responsibility you have. So wield it judiciously.
As Spider-Man would say, yes, with great power.
So first off, before we get, let's emanate out from California, shall we? Because you are in California, you follow this stuff, and like I said at the beginning of the show, my experience in my life has been, you know, first it was skateboards, then it was, first it was roller skates, then skateboards, then inline skating, everything that happens in California, and that horrible Proposition 13, I think it was, or 3,
right,
I can't
right.
remember which one you called mm-hmm. it there, but we got it in Massachusetts. And it decimated my public school. Thank you. And
you're welcome.
So give us a sense of – talk to me about some of the things that happened in California. I know some of the big stories are online registration. Let's start with that, because we just talked to Ari Berman, and he cited that. What were the implications of online registration this year in California?
They were really significant, and I think what it's done, it's kind of a microcosm of what happened nationwide. I mean, nationwide you saw this sort of rising American electorate, this McGovern coalition, that's a governing coalition of minorities and women and educated liberals or whatever that electorate looks like, is now one that is a majority of the country, at least in national elections. Well, what happened in California was that they passed this bill that allowed people to register to vote online. And, you know, combine that with vote by mail, and you literally never have to encounter any poll worker or registrar in California to register and, you know, make your vote. They put this in, I think it started late September, and it was open for only 3 weeks to a month. And in that time, 1 million people, basically 5%, over 5% of the entire electorate, registered online in that very short three-week window. And what this did is it completely upended and transformed the voter universe in California. We had a very close race. It's kind of the legacy of Prop 13. We had a statewide ballot measure, Prop 30, that would raise taxes on people making over $250,000 a year and raise sales taxes a very small amount, $1 for every $400 you spend, on everybody. And this was to fill a $6 billion a year structural deficit that is a legacy of Prop 13. And the polls all showed this tightening coming into the election and topping out really at 48%. And the rule of thumb in California is if you're not above 50% in the polls with a ballot measure before Election Day, you're not going to get there. I mean, that's been the clear rule of thumb. Well, Prop 30 passed with 54% of the vote. And it's clear to me that the pollsters were not modeling the same voter universe that we now have. And the other big example of this is that, you know, again, a legacy of Prop 13 is that you need a two-thirds majority for any increases in revenue in the state of California. Used to be you need two-thirds for the budget as well, but a ballot measure a couple years ago got rid of that. But it's still there for revenue, which is, of course, half of the budget. You know, a budget is made up of revenue and spending. So there was no belief that Democrats were going to be able, in a redistricted environment, and it was independent redistricting, it wasn't gerrymandered, they did not feel that they were going to be able to get a two-thirds majority in the legislature, particularly in the assembly. And I heard high-ranking state officials say, you might as well expect Obama to win Alabama if you expect Democrats to get a two-thirds majority in the Assembly. Well, guess what? Democrats got the two-thirds majority in the Assembly and the State Senate, and now the irony is that they spent years trying to pass this statewide ballot measure to get, you know, because of the two-thirds majority, to pass a statewide measure to raise taxes. And now, lo and behold, they can do it themselves in the legislature because they finally got this long-sought two-thirds majority for the first time in, I believe, 80 years.
Wow.
So I believe it's entirely due to this change in the voter universe in California, 1 million new registrants. And that's only going to get better because same-day registration is going to be in place for the 2014 election. You're going to have online voter reg open for more than just 3 weeks before the election. It's really changing the map, and that's what we also saw nationwide. So I think there's a lot of parallels there.
That's fascinating. I mean, that is that is fascinating. There's only a handful of states that have online voter registration
that I know of. Yes, and California kind of bucked the trend here. The trend, and I'm sure Ari Berman talked about this with you, was to limit voter participation.
Yes.
And when you limit voter participation, you can only go so far with swamping Republicans with a turnout model. I mean, this is what they tried in all kinds of states. And if it wasn't for a very diligent judicial effort, they would have succeeded in many cases in limiting voter participation. But what we did in California is we expanded voter participation in a preliminary way, and amazing things can happen when you give people the franchise and make it easy for people to vote. We saw this obviously in Colorado and Washington, where we have marijuana legalization.
Yes, not medical marijuana, not medical marijuana. No. Medical marijuana passed in Massachusetts, but right. We're talking in Washington, Colorado. I mean, at least I've read more about Washington than I have Colorado. But in Washington, you can have up to an ounce of pot. And then it just changes, depends on what form. Like there's you can have more as a liquid, more as a pot brownies. And right. They have a whole excise tax regime they're starting to implement. It's going to be interesting. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with that with the federal government. But go ahead.
Sure. And what is the unifying characteristic in those two states? Washington is 100% vote by mail, which everybody gets a ballot in the mail, and there's our facilities set up so that you can, even on the same day of the election, put them in. To a receptacle. So, and Colorado has virtual 100% vote by mail to the extent that I believe 80% of the Colorado electorate voted before the day of the election. So, when you expand the franchise, when you make it as easy as possible for people to vote, when you don't make it so that they have to wait in a line for 4 hours on a Tuesday when they have to work, when you give them all these opportunities and alternatives, great things can happen.
So what happened in California with the GMO labeling?
Well, I mean, money still talks
at
a certain level.
Right.
And the food service organizations, people like Monsanto, spent tens of millions of dollars to beat that back. On the ground. And I think you can expand that out nationally and say that, you know, at the presidential level, at the level of the statewide races, the U.S. Senate, even these statewide ballot measures that were very high profile, you can blunt the power of big money through organization and just the new demographics of the electorate. When you start getting to the district level, or even at the statewide level where it's not the highest priority on the ticket, money talks still.
Right. I would put the percentage of the public that even knows what the initials GMO means somewhere probably in the teens would be my guess.
Right.
That's an example.
And you know, we saw state legislatures had kind of a mixed night for Democrats. They picked up a couple chambers here and there, but they also lost some, including the Wisconsin State Senate, which was won through a diligent series of recalls. Republicans won that back last night. And at the, you know, congressional district level, we did not see the gains expected for Democrats. A lot of that was due to redistricting, which probably, you know, the 2012 election for Democrats in the House was probably set by the 2012 election results in state legislatures, because then they redistricted the seats to make it, you know, give Republicans a clear advantage. But I think you also have to attribute that to the power of money. And so all of these Citizens United, post-Citizens United campaign finance changes and eases, they matter when the race isn't so high profile. That's what I think we can learn from the results.
And you know what's stunning to me is that we had three states that passed an affirmative referendum in terms of marriage equality. We had one state that basically passed a referendum saying that you can't ban marriage equality, and
Did Minnesota pass? Did the Minnesota referendum?
Wait, no. It they voted against the gay marriage ban.
Oh, okay. Right.
I should say so. And
basically, LGBT rights won at the ballot in four states yesterday.
Yeah, and it's what's also amazing is just sort of like that's, you know, fifth on my list at this point. I mean, we've come so far that right. is not a, you know, that's a dog bites man story.
Yeah, I would say two things on that. Number one, it's just a testament to the incredible organizing that has been done by the LGBT community over the last several years. This used to be a wedge issue. This used to be the kind of issue Karl Rove would put on the ballot. And it's not like that was 30 years ago. It right. was 10 years ago
right.
that Republicans would put that issue on the ballot directly to hurt Democrats in various races.
2004.
And now it's a situation, yeah, where it's the exact opposite. And in fact, I was talking about state legislatures. In Maine and Minnesota, that's where Democrats performed the best in state legislatures, winning back both chambers. And that those are races where LGBT rights were on the ballot. I think it brought out, you know, core liberals in those two states. I think it helped the overall ticket in a big way. That would be the number one thing I would say. And number two is that, you know, we hear a lot about how the presidential bully pulpit doesn't matter. And I think that needs to be put to bed, because after the president affirmatively came out for marriage equality, here's what happened. It was 0-33 on the ballot, but until that happened, and now it's 4-0. And I don't think you can discount the importance of leadership at the top on that issue.
That's a great point. When he came out in favor of marriage equality, it had absolutely no statutory, bureaucratic, no implications whatsoever beyond changing the tenor of the way that society perceived it. And
absolutely.
Yeah, I think the notion that the bully pulpit is non-existent is a joke, because those same people say, well, if it wasn't for Frank Santelli's rant, you know, like that guy's got that guy's got a bully
exactly.
pulpit, but the president doesn't. Yeah. I mean, you know, wait a second here.
Exactly.
You know, that seems pretty stunning. Let me ask you this, because the sort of the theme of the program today has been, and we haven't, has been, you know, that there, you get the Peggy Noonan types, the David Brooks types, even Dick Morris types, Britt Hume, coming out and saying that we have to recognize that the electorate is different now. We may have to change. Oh, I think we just lost them. Hold on for a second. Bear with me, folks. It's radio.
Hello.
Hey, sorry. We lost you
for
me. So what I was saying is that
let's roll it back.
Thematically for the program today, we've been talking about the David Brooks, the Peggy Noonans, Britt Hume, Dick Morris even today saying that we need, as Republicans, if we ever want to participate nationally again, we need to recognize that the electorate has changed and change our positions. And I did a little random rush thing where just maybe this was not even a coincidence, because, of course, he's saying this all day. He's saying we shouldn't do this. Why should we, essentially? And the do you think that we are at the point now, not only because I don't think that the Republicans have the ability, frankly, to change their positions on immigration, to change their positions on things like birth control access, or that legitimate rape, non-legitimate rape, because they're just too electorally tied up in a coalition of racists and fundamentalists. I mean, it's just too big of a part of their coalition. Are we near the point where we will start to see, 4 years from now perhaps, that we start to see affirmative referendum establishing these rights for, you know, whether it's immigration reform, whether it's more sovereignty for women over their bodies, where we start to see this being a cudgel used against them? In other words, we're now at the point where what used to be an electoral advantage for them is now an electoral advantage for us in terms of marriage equality. Will we see this start to happen with things like immigration and abortion rights?
I think with respect to immigration, absolutely. Harry Reid had a press availability just an hour ago, and he said that immigration would be very high on his agenda. It would be political malpractice if Democrats, after the top of the ticket getting 70% of the Latino vote, according to exit polls, for them not to essentially every week put up a vote related to immigration until they actually win a majority on that. I think they're absolutely going to go in that direction. I think they're not so insipid that they don't see the demographic staring them in the face on that one. As far as abortion rights, you know, I mean, four anti-choice Democrats won races in the Senate last night. Tim Kaine and Joe Donnelly. I mean, everyone was freaked out about Richard Murdoch and his views on rape. And, you know, Joe Donnelly's anti-choice, and, right. and he was the opponent. So I think that the way that abortion was talked about in this campaign did show a rhetorical shift, at least at the national level. I'm not convinced that that will translate in a big way. I listened to Rush Limbaugh, too, as is hopefully going to be a quadrennial habit to see what he could possibly say after another loss. And what he really said was that we tried reaching out to minorities. We put Condoleezza Rice on stage, is essentially what he said. And what he said was is that his traditional conservatism, his view of what America is all about, is outnumbered. Now, he said that in a very a sneering way, that people, you know, you can't fight against Santa Claus, that Obama was promising everything to everybody and free stuff, and you can't beat that. But the word outnumbered, I think, is pretty critical when you're looking at how conservatives are going to reckon with this. I don't think they can. I don't think there's I agree with you. There's not going to be a civil war in the party, both sides of the Confederacy. It would be a silly civil war.
Right.
But there's a recognition, and particularly at the mainstream media level, a recognition that this demography is destiny thing that Democrats have talked about for about a decade may be coming to pass. I mean, Democrats have now won the popular vote in five of the last six presidential elections.
That's right. That's right.
So it's not like this just snuck up on us. The key, I think, for Democrats, and particularly for grassroots Democrats, activists, is to try to reconcile the governing majority at the electoral level, this diverse liberal majority, with who the representatives of that are at the policy level. Because Democrats have now played this game where they run on a position of populism and then get in office and go away from that.
Yes.
And so I remember hearing a couple of years ago, it's like the McGovern coalition is a governing coalition. Now we just need someone more like McGovern to represent it. And we don't have that with Barack Obama. I think I think he would run screaming from that characterization himself. So I don't think I'm saying anything out of turn. The point is that the liberal victory that was that occurred in last night needs to be reflected in policy to a stronger degree than it is than it was certainly in the first 4 years of Barack Obama's presidency.
And, you know, that is the conversation that we that I hope to have with you in the coming days, weeks, months, because that is really that is the fundamental. That's the nut. Right. I mean, how do we the President Obama, since basically Labor Day of last year, ran a more populist campaign. And now how do we hold them to it? I mean, if there was online registration in the entire country, there's no way they could cut Social Security, right? I mean, there's just no way. There's just no way.
Right.
I just think that it would be just too hard. But that is essentially the battle that is in front of us. Yeah. And I think that's a good place to leave it. David, I appreciate you taking the time. I know you must be exhausted.
No problem. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, folks. Well, you know what? We're going to Freebie Thursday. What is today? Wednesday.
Wow. I feel like it's not Wednesday, too, though.
Freebie Wednesday for folks.
Let's do it.
Let's go into
play another Decomposure.
Yes,
song.
Let's play another Decomposure song. This is Decomposure from Blank Squirrel Records. You can find the link at our site at majority.fm. When we come back, I'll be taking your phone calls at 646-257-3920. The IM is fired up. I will probably do another Random Rush in the better half of the program. Got to. He's just having too much of a meltdown. I think, that, you know, Dan put it very well. The bottom line is we have now shown the electoral strength. We have seen it on an electoral level. How does that translate into a policy level? Because we know that the leadership of the Democratic Party, and not all, but certainly the key positions are more corporatist, establishment, money friendly. And the question is, how do we translate this electoral strength into the policy level? And I guess we'll see. I mean, you know, look, as Dan put it, it would be political malpractice for the Democrats not to pursue immigration reform because it is a very important issue for the Latino community, and they voted 70%. And so, you know, this is, I don't know if that's where the clue is, but we, you know, in the coming weeks and months, we're going to be talking about this quite a bit. Maybe as soon as tomorrow, we'll be talking about what's going to happen with the grand bargain. What are the dynamics? We now have a considerably maybe exaggerating it, but we have a more liberal Senate than we had 2 days ago. I mean, that is the reality. Where's my list? In Montana, we have a +2 pickup. Tester is what he was. Some things, yes. Some things, no. Heitkamp from North Dakota replacing Conrad. I mean, that's a wash. Kent Conrad.
She'll be similar to him. I mean,
right.
It's better to have a conservative Democrat than a radical right Republican.
Indeed.
From a state like that.
Bob Kerry loses in Nebraska, so we lose that seat, but saves me a considerable amount of heartburn. Elizabeth Warren, there's every reason to believe, if you believe that a senator can do anything, that this senator is going to be one who does that. If you believe that a strong liberal in the Senate, who has already shown her willingness to buck up against the elite in this country, can have any value, she is that person. And when you have a guy like Sherrod Brown, when you have Elizabeth Warren, when you have Tammy Baldwin, the first gay senator in the history of the country, but also strong progressive. I mean, to have them 6 years away from an election and to have one election under Sherrod Brown's belt and to have Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, where she's not going to have to worry, I think, about reelection for a long time, if ever, is key. I mean, these are key. And Chris Murphy in Connecticut, huge upgrade from Joe Lieberman. Now, Donnelly in Indiana may be the new Joe Lieberman, but that was Dick Lugar before. So that's an upgrade-ish. McCaskill, still McCaskill. But so there, we have moved
but
the
not
Senate.
Todd Akin.
But not Todd Akin. But she was McCaskill before. So we have moved the Senate to the left. And I'm looking forward to Al Franken's second term, frankly, because I think the reality is when you win an election by 120 votes, it puts you in a bit of a box. You do not have the latitude that you have if you come from a state like Massachusetts. And when you do have someone like, you know, the thing about like Kennedy that he used to provide was a whole lot of breathing space on the left of people in the Senate. You understand, like a marker is placed and it stretches the parameters of the debate. And Kennedy could do that because Kennedy had that seat for as long as he wanted it. And I'm hoping that we're going to see some of this out of New York a little bit. I mean, can you imagine if we had voter registration, online registration in New York? I mean, this would make a huge difference, I think. So, all right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a second. We'll take your phone calls.
I arrived at work some Friday morning early, oh say. Flatted out on sleep, mouth dragging down from my coffee fix. Check my email, waiting for it's on at JWG.com. Wanted to give me $10,000 so Lacey's could use my song.
That is a test by Decomposure on Blank Squirrel Records. Remember, if you get it at bandcamp.com, use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 20% off. It's like getting it for free, practically. Let's go to the phones, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. It's Logan from New York. Welcome to the program, Logan.
Hey, Sam. What's up, man? Just wanted to say, you know, voter suppression should be a national issue for Democrats. They should run on it as, you know, if you want everyone to vote, vote Democrat. If you really want to stop people from voting, vote Republican. And I feel like governors should be running on that on a regular basis.
I agree. In some states, sadly, the majority of people don't want everybody to vote. There's a history of that, particularly down in the South. But there are a lot of states where I think that can be an effective message.
Now, I also want to say that the current economic stuff coming up, the issues, I really want to see people start talking about unemployment rate as a sort of a bellwether of when we should be doing deficit reduction. I mean, don't you think it should be like we shouldn't try to go for deficit reduction until we get the unemployment rate under a certain number?
Absolutely. Of course. Absolutely. 100%. Sadly, from a rhetorical standpoint, we're not seeing it from the president. He will not make that argument. There are some who argue, and I think there is a decent argument. There are some who argue that he talks austerity, but has been, you know, attempting to spend money or to stimulate when he can. I think there's I would say that I'm 50-50 on that argument, but be that as it may, from a rhetorical standpoint, he mentioned the deficit. He mentioned this whole notion of saddling our children with debt. Look, you know what? My kid, if I don't have a job, they're not worried about the debt they're going to have in 25 years, supposedly.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're going to have a lot more of it if they can't eat now, and I can't send them to school or whatever. I can't put it. I mean, the bottom line is we need to put people back to work. We need jobs, and we need to figure out a way of doing that. Now, you know, I read a lot of different people online. There's a lot of people, you know, who are saying, well, now we're going to see what Barack Obama really is. And I think that's probably I think that's true. I happen to think that we probably have a good sense already, but whatever. There are also some people out there who are saying, like, I genuinely believe, people who I have a lot of respect for, who are saying, like, with the R&D money that is coming out of the Energy Department, that there is a real opportunity to really shift the nature of our economy in some ways. And, you know, so it remains to be seen. But there are going to be some fights that are going to be very obvious for us. And the first ones up, I think, are going to be protecting social insurance programs in this country.
And finally, one more thing, is Citizens United. Doesn't it look like Citizens United might actually be benefiting us, because it puts this all this money in? First of all, it stimulates the economy. It puts all this money in there, and it's all these rich guys who think they know what kind of messages are going to win, almost backfiring on them, because I'm sure they put out a lot of ads that backfired on them using all that money. So, I mean, isn't there some kind of weird thing going on with Citizens United where it's almost hurting its own goals?
I had this conversation with Berman. I think this time around, yes. Although I think in probably some smaller races, it was effective. But this time around, yes. But eventually, this money's going to wise up. You know, you're going to, you know, this is, what's that guy's name from our town, the Hill? Music Man, the Hill, Harry Hill, or whatever it is, the guy who comes in and is a snake oil salesman. At one point, I think these rich people are gonna wake up a little bit. Although it's quite possible there could be just a whole new group of snake oil salesmen. But yes, this is, look, I said this, I can't remember the guy's name who owns the Cubs. But when they came out with his agenda, like, we're going to finally vet the president and this guy's going to spend the money on this, that's when it became very clear to me that, like, I've seen this dynamic play out. Frankly, I saw it at Air America. I saw, I'm not joking, I saw guys come in with supposedly radio guys. They'd come in and they would see this dumb money right there on the table, and they would just milk it. I mean, just drain it out of that person, because that person didn't know what was going on, and they allowed this person to define the agenda, and then they also allowed them to define the metrics of success. And when you have a 12-month window horizon, right, you start spending money now. And Logan, listen, you got to get me, this is the way it is, to really move opinion, you got to spend a lot of money. And, you know, and so you give me $10 million, and 3 months from now, you're going, like, where's that opinion? And I'm like, well, I'm telling you, this is not, if you think this is something you can do in 90 days, absolutely not. No, you need 210 days. So, and another 10 million. You give me that 10 million, we're now 210 days out. And you say to me, Sam, what's going on? I'm not seeing the movement. And I'm like, in for a penny, in for a pound. Sometimes it takes a little bit more. So what we need is another 50 days and another $25 million, because otherwise you've just wasted $20 million, and you give me that $25 million. I mean, I've seen this happen. I saw it happen time and time again. And the more I see this dynamic out there, I realize this is how the world works. And somehow I'm not getting in on this. Appreciate the phone call, Logan. Yeah, well, we can talk if you've got $20 million. All right.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Thanks, man.
Bye. Let's go to Greg from New York. Welcome to the program, Greg.
Hey, Sam.
What's up?
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
I'm excellent. First of all, I just wanted to say the word that's on everyone's mind today. Maybe it's two words, I don't know, which is woo!
I think that's one word, but go ahead. A woo-hoo. Okay. Let me tell you something. My daughter, last night, my dad ended up, I think my sister told my dad that Mila was on the show yesterday. My daughter was on the show. And so he listened to the show. He called her, and they spoke because my daughter had name dropped him in her research on Massachusetts. When Milo went to bed before, obviously the election was over, but she was awake when Massachusetts was called, and I have not seen a more ecstatic reaction to anything in my life. When the news said that Obama won Massachusetts, Mila just like thrust her hands into the air. It was just like, yeah! She was so excited. Now, she's seven, and I didn't want to say like that was pretty predictable. I didn't want to say drones or that was predictable. There was neither one I wanted to say. But yeah, I mean, it's at the very least, it's a in terms of the presidential election, it's a big relief. I think it would have been very, very just horrible for the country to have elected Mitt Romney. And frankly, I also think that if it was possible to elect Mitt Romney, you would have also probably, in all likelihood, seen the Republicans control all three branches of government, and that would have been just an unmitigated disaster. Both for the country and for the left, in my opinion, because...
Right. I could definitely see Nate Silver somewhere going, yep, I knew that.
Yeah, like definitely.
Like in a very monotone voice.
Well, listen, I appreciate the phone call. I got to jump, though.
Okay, man. See ya.
Bye. The IM for non-AOL... For non-AOL IMers is majorityfm@jabber.org. majorityfm@jabber.org. Continuing on with our theme about the realization on the right of what has happened in this country. Last night, before the results came in, even though it was clear what was going to happen, and I'm quite convinced that everybody at Fox was drunk, here is Bill O'Reilly sitting back and telling everybody what's what. You know, I've been on air for 15 years. I'm making far more money than I ever should. Let me just tell you what's going on.
This is hypothetical. We don't know who's even winning right now, never mind who won. But how do you think it got this tight?
Because it's a changing country. The demographics are changing. It's not a traditional America anymore. And there are 50%.
Pause it. A traditional America. Let's examine that idea for a moment. What is a traditional America? Well, for Bill O'Reilly, it's the America that he grew up in. Lily White on Long Island. You know, working class white guys with my mom in the kitchen. Although my dad wasn't necessarily working class. And he went to, I think, Harvard, I believe. But that's what traditional America is, you know, where women are the chattel of their husbands, but black people don't have the opportunity to eat in a restaurant if it's a white restaurant economically participate.
But I mean, how far back do we go for traditional America? Is traditional America with slave owners?
Well, that's traditional. In fact, that was quite a long tradition in this country. Also, child labor. That was a fairly big tradition in this country. Continue.
Of the voting public who want stuff. They want things. And who is going to give them things? President Obama. He knows it, and he ran on it. And whereby 20 years ago, President Obama would be roundly defeated by an establishment candidate like Mitt Romney. The white establishment is now the minority. And the voters, many of them, feel that this economic system is stacked against them, and they want stuff. You're going to see a tremendous Hispanic vote for President Obama. Overwhelming black vote for President Obama. And women will probably break President Obama's way. People feel that they are entitled to things, and which candidate between the two is going to give them things.
Bill, will you stick around for a couple of minutes?
So here's the reality. The white establishment wants things too. They're not just involved in controlling government because, hey, we care about everybody else. No, everybody wants something from government. That's why we create governments. We feel that coming together as a society, the sum of the total will be greater than its parts. The white establishment wanted stuff only for the white establishment. And now that they have to share, within the words of Bill O'Reilly, with the minorities and the women, the white establishment is pissed about it and thinks everything's been there's been all this massive upheaval. Well, there has been. Now everybody gets a share of the pie. You don't get to keep the pie for yourself anymore, Bill O'Reilly. Your female producers are no longer there just so that you have something to really think about in the shower. They actually have their own lives and their own careers. They function not to fulfill some small aspect of your life, but in fact to fulfill their own. That is what you're lamenting. So yes, you're right. African Americans, Latinos, women, they want something from government. And that means that the white establishment is no longer allowed to take all of it from government. Let's go back to the phones. We'll get to the IMs in just a second. Susan from Austin. Welcome to the program, Susan.
Hello. And is this more fun listening to the Fox people? They don't know if they've been shot or snake bit. It's like the spin coming out of them and trying to figure out which end is up. And that's kind of what I wanted to comment on last night when we were watching Britt Hume stumble over his words. And my 16-year-old, who's pretty sharp, when Britt Hume was talking about the exit polls, saying all these people who identified as moderates are identifying themselves wrongly. There's more liberals out there than what we originally thought. And my 16-year-old, I mean, he just made a stunning analysis, I thought. He said, you mean to tell me that they accept the premise that it's easier for these people to believe that millions of people or thousands of people, whatever it was, poll wrongly identify themselves as moderates when in fact they're liberals, instead of saying maybe it's the fact that they see Obama as the moderate that he is, and they identify with Obama as a moderate who's really right a center. I mean, it's like their whole framework is skewed. It's easier for them to believe, no, all these people think they're moderates, really they're liberals, and so they're voting for this really liberal president, when in fact it's, no, they're moderate or maybe slightly right of center, and that's why they like Obama. There was a conservative pundit this morning on Diane Reams who did the same thing. He said, I don't understand. All the polling, exit polling suggests that people, you know, the economy was still a big issue and why they didn't vote on that. And it's like, doofus, they did vote on economic issues. You just don't like the result. Right. I mean, it's just their bubble is so freaking complete. They don't even hear what's coming out of their mouth. But
I got to admit,
anyway.
Susan, that I didn't, you know, I think your son is very astute because I think the idea that they perceive Obama as a moderate as opposed to a liberal is a legitimate take, and you know that hadn't occurred to me. I think the reality is that the names liberal and moderate are imprecise. We don't have a word for people in this country who are to the left of liberals, because to a large extent, one could argue that President Obama is a liberal, but that the problem with liberals is that they are not attuned enough to economic justice. That, I mean, Fran Lebowitz used to come on the Majority Report and would say the problem with liberals is money. And, yeah. I, you know, I, you know, so we're getting to a semantics thing here, but the reality is that they cannot absorb, fundamentally, they cannot absorb that their perspective is out of the mainstream of the country, if you're going to define the mainstream of the country as the capacity to elect a president.
I'll end with this. And my son is 16. You know, he's an astute kid. He wants to be involved in policymaking. But if he's the next generation that's coming, and they have completely lost he's not even listening to these people anymore because they're so far out. And they're so out of touch with anything that pertains to his life or what he's interested in or what he thinks, what he perceives as important. And I mean, it's like, and that he represents the next big wave of incoming voters. And yep. I mean, they are in a world of trouble. But anyway,
I think you're absolutely
thanks
right.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Susan. I appreciate the phone call. Let's go to the IM. We got callers on the line. We'll get to them in a second. DD, think today would be a good day to do a random rush. Indeed, it was. We did one. Bush and Chains, meanwhile, back in reality land, the Dow is tanking 300 points, showing Obama and the rest of the celebratory P-brains just who is really in control. Oh, and for you Apple, the funny thing is, like, Bush and Chains, if the Dow was up, if bank stocks were up instead of down right now, he would write back, bankers know exactly who they wanted to win. And so there was, come on, Bush and Chains.
I love that. Come on, Bush and Chains.
Smith & Wesson stock seems to be doing just fine, though, and that had to be the best random rush ever. But you cut it off before Limpy gave us the punchline. Turn it back on, if nothing else, the pure comedy. Didn't Rush Limbaugh say he'd move out of this country if President Obama wins again? Limbaugh complaining that Republicans don't get credit for Condi Rice. She's well-spoken. We're outnumbered. We've lost the country. Bush & Cheney's Ted Nugent. I will be dead or in jail if Obama's reelected. That's right. One day ago, Pat Robertson believes Romney will win 337-201 in the Electoral College. I am still am praying and relying on the only person who can truly help, our Lord Jesus Christ. Glenn Beck, a Romney win would be a clear sign from God. 2 weeks ago, Glenn Beck, God wants Mitt to win the election. Bush and Chains, when does effeminate Nate Silver collect his cash from Scarborough? Behave yourself. Behave yourself. Matt told me the best I am he saw. If you're on the phone, now hang on, folks. I will get to all of you. The best tweet he saw was
Andrew Breitbart, oddly quiet for an election night.
Lawyer Matthew, great time working the polls yesterday in North Philly. Lawyer Matthew went down to Philly, folks, to protect your voting rights. No Romney workers all day. Yeah, I think that whole true the vote thing, I think just never actually seemed to have materialized. I know they got kicked out in Ohio. Great time working the polls. Voters were very motivated, having seen what happens in local Pennsylvania elections when they don't show up. I hope that they retain that. Who else we got on the phone? Let's see. Let's go to Carl in Ohio. Welcome to the program, Carl.
Good afternoon, Sammy. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Hey, Ari Berman said one thing that, to my knowledge, is the first time anyone like that has said this in public, that Title V needs to be expanded to all 50 states. And I have been screaming this, I swear to God, for months, and no one else appears to me anyway to have been saying this. And that, you know, if we know that the GOP, and with Karl Rove and others directing this, is, you know, trying to direct a 50-state southern strategy, then this needs to be fought back with a 50-state Voting Rights Act, including Title V. And I can't believe that more people have not focused on this, because to me, it's absolutely clear.
I agree, and I don't know what it's going to take. We now have I don't know what the official count is in terms of women in the Senate, but I think we have more female senators in the Senate than I think we have at any other time. There's a couple on from the Republicans as well, and this is good. It brings another perspective in there. We do not have any African American senators, and I'm not saying
that
this
is
should,
true. Yeah.
I'm not saying this should be an issue that only an African American senator should bring up, but the reality is that the majority of people are being disenfranchised. When we talk about Title V, we're talking about minority voters. And there needs to be a champion in the Senate for this. There needs to be someone who is on the national stage speaking about this. And we have seen President Obama's reluctance in the past to take any position that could be associated as one having to do with race. And maybe that will change. I mean, but I agree. There needs to be a massive push for voting rights right now, because, you know, look.
I think so. I think in addition, I would say that the Democratic Party is continuing not to defend itself when it stands to be the clear loser from voter obstruction tactics. That again and again, we're seeing the Green Party. We're seeing people like Bob Petraeus here in Columbus step in and do what they will not do, even when it's not the Greens themselves who stand to benefit from it from the Democrats. This I can't believe this. But, yeah. I mean, this has been the pattern since 2000. It's the Greens who step up.
Yeah.
And it's the Democrats who lose, but they don't defend themselves.
I just don't think – I mean, I think you have to look at the individuals involved, and then, you know, there it's – it's tough to say the Democrats, because you've got to look at the individual incentives that each one has and their particular agendas. And, that's why it's so hard. It's in every state has their own voting laws. An expanded Title V, though, would certainly go a long way, at least in dealing with some of the more nefarious things that some of these Republican state legislators are doing. But appreciate the call, buddy.
Yeah. Oh, can I just get a couple of things in quickly?
Yes.
One is that at least as of this morning, Amy Goodman was saying that Alan West had still not conceded.
No.
So evidently he's waiting for word from Jesus Christ. And the other thing, this is kind of interesting, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces an even more awkward time with Washington and re-energized critics at home who accused him on Wednesday of backing the loser in the U.S. presidential election. So, mwah.
Yes, no, I'm glad. I would have to say Bibi is one of the big losers in this, without a doubt. Appreciate the call, buddy. We just don't have time to get into every element of this, but over the coming days we will, of course. Okajik from New York, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Is this Okajik?
It's Okajik.
Oh my gosh.
Okajik.
Long-time IMer. What's up?
Yes. From way back. First of all, very very happy about the results in the election last night. I think we dodged a serious bullet.
Yep.
And I was one of the few people. We have a little house in Central Mass. I was like one Elizabeth Warren yard sign for miles.
Where in Central Mass?
Everything else was Scott Brown. Granville, near Westfield.
I don't even know where that is. I'm in Worcester.
Pioneer Valley.
All right.
Okay. Anyway, I have a couple of concerns. After the election, it started immediately last night, a complete reframing of what I think what happened with the pundits on TV saying that, you know, people are for deficit reduction, they want small government, and they're socially liberal, but they're conservative economically, more of like a libertarianism thing. And I think that Democrats are really going to have a problem. I think they really need to be assertive with doing a more populist, progressive agenda.
No,
and
look,
I also think that Republicans are going to be obstructionists for another 4 years, hoping that they
definitely
can get somebody.
Michelle Bachmann won in her race, and I think that's a benefit for those of us on the left, because we want the base of power. If the Republicans are going to control the House, we want them to be as extreme as possible. We want them not to even come close to being able to sign off on some type of grand bargain. Democrat, we can't count on the Democrats to do anything. We, as constituents, we as just citizens, we as on the left, need to fight for these populist measures. We need to strike back.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that was the point that I was wanting us to get across here. You know, it doesn't end with the election. We have to fight. You know, hopefully the Democrats have, you know, their ears are more open to us, and we have to push for what it is, you know, that we feel the country needs.
Couldn't agree with you more, buddy. Thanks for calling in. Great to hear from you.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Going back to, all right, well, we got to do this. Got a little bit of time. This was just too good. So I don't know if you were watching Fox News last night. I was. I mean, I actually was watching Fox, MSNBC, and CNN. Two different computers going on. I had one earplug was Fox, one earplug was CNN. MSNBC was on. And whenever Nikki was like, can we see what's going on Fox? I'm like, no, I'm already watching it. Well, wait, I want to watch it too. And I'm like, I can't do that because I have this whole thing. This whole thing is set up, and I have to be near my computer, and I've got this one ear plug in. And then at one point, like, you want to be watching Fox when they call it for President Obama. And here is the moment where they call Ohio for President Obama on Fox. And everyone else knows in the universe that if Ohio goes for President Obama, it's over. It's just a question of how big, but it's over. Now, I'm pretty convinced, because I was watching Fox in the lead up to this, and I don't know what time this was at, probably around 11:30 or somewhere around there. I'm pretty convinced that they were drinking at Fox. I don't know if Brett Baer was, but Megyn Kelly, some of the guys in their like little war room, I'm pretty convinced were drinking, like Trippy and Barone. I'm pretty convinced that they were drunk. And so here's the call for Ohio, and then it's like, have you ever seen anybody run in? I remember once I was playing frisbee with somebody as a kid. And the frisbee went over my head, and I ran backwards, but watching in front of me to catch the frisbee, and I banged into a tree. And I just froze in a state of shock for like 3 seconds as my brain processed what just happened, and then I collapsed on the ground. That's what I think just happened here with Fox last night. Here it is.
Fox News can now project that President Obama will win the crucial battleground state of Ohio.
And there's a question now about, you know, what does that mean, panel? I mean, does that mean that
that's the presidency?
That's it.
Essentially, Barack Obama is re-elected.
You know, some unbelievable miracle would have to occur in some completely. I don't see how this isn't going to happen.
Yeah, you know what that miracle would be? The aliens came down and evaporated Ohio. With some type of big Ohio evaporation gun. That was Brit Hume saying, like, well, I don't want to say that it's over, but it's over. But the whole night, I have to say, with Fox was like one of those scenes in a movie where, like two cops, where the partner gets shot. And the cop comes over and he cradles his partner as he sort of drifts off into death. That's what Fox looked like to me. It was like they were just cradling all these conservatives and just sort of saying like, it's okay. I'm going to, don't worry. We'll remember you. So, and then I don't know what was the best moment. The next best moment on Fox. After Megyn Kelly was like, okay, Ohio's been called. What does that mean? Well, it means that's the presidency. That's what? 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 The president? I mean, We've only been studying for months as to what the Electoral College is. We've only been waiting for 4 hours as to what's going to happen if Ohio goes to President Obama. Now that it's gone to him, what does that mean? Yeah, it means you lost. But what do you do if you have been suckling at the teat of billionaires, telling them that they're going to win if they just give you money to go out and buy ads where you get a 10, 15% markup part of that money? Well, you hang on white-knuckled. And that's exactly what Karl Rove did. Here is Chris Wallace making the call on Ohio. And Karl Rove going, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
Well, I have great respect for our decision desk, and I see that they're very happy in Chicago, but I've got to tell you, the Romney camp has real doubts about the call that's been made by us, and I guess other networks, about Ohio. They do not believe that Ohio is in the Obama camp. I just got an email from a top Romney person. I said, do you agree with our call? He said, not really. It is less than 20,000 votes.
Not really? That doesn't seem like a strong refutation to me. Do you agree with our call? Not really.
Now with 20% of the vote still out in GOP areas, Carl was just on the phone with somebody else, and you got some more recent figures.
Well, here it is. The Secretary of the networks, our network called on the basis of about 74% of the vote being in. The Secretary of State website has 77.49% of the vote in, and it shows 2,229,686 votes for President Obama with 49.19% of the vote, and for Governor Romney, 2,228,695, a 911 vote difference, 49.17.
And we say it's a 900 Obama is leading 900 votes.
When it was at 74%, it was 20 some odd thousand votes. Now with
okay, so there he is. He's going on and on. Nobody at Fox. I think half of them were in the bag, frankly. I think half of them were drunk. And because I think they knew this was going to be a long night and Romney's going to lose. But Karl Rove still jibber-jabbing about the numbers. I'm looking at the numbers and blah, 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 blah. And then he continues on. This is going on for minutes.
I think this is premature. We got 70. We got a quarter of the vote. Now, remember, here's the thing about Ohio. A third of the vote or more is cast early. That is won overwhelmingly by the Democrats. It's counted first. And then you count the election day. And the question is, by the time you finish counting.
Yeah, Karl Rove's got the math. He's got the math, everybody. He's working out the numbers. He's going to go back to the website. He's going to check the website.
I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but we got to be careful about calling things when we have like 991 votes separating the two candidates.
And he goes on and on, on and on.
Like precincts, I'd be very cautious about intruding in this process.
Well, folks,
thanks.
So maybe not so fast.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. It's great to have you guys here.
That's awkward.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to get someone from the decision desk, and we're going to bring them in here. And we're going to have them on air, and we're going to interview them about this decision.
Well, I think we should sit them next to Karl Rove and interview both of them. Let them interview each other.
Michael.
Yeah, they're drunk. And then what happens is Megyn Kelly gets up because they can't get the people from their segment producers or wherever it is who called it. So she walks down the hall, goes in and talks to him. The guy just looks up at her and says, well, you know, it's what we do for a living. All we do is crunch these numbers. And she said, are you sure? And the guy says, yeah, well, I'm 99.998% sure. Yeah. And she's like, okay, I'll go back and tell Carl. And then they have to bring somebody out to debate Carl because he will not let go because he has already exposed himself. And so he's not going to back down. He figures in his mind, and he was smart, if I keep this up for another 45 minutes, half the people are going to go to bed anyways, and I'm not going to have to. I'm going to have one-third the audience in which I sort of slink off. And that's exactly what happened. I got to say I enjoyed it. All right, final call of the day. Art from Winnipeg, welcome to the program, Art.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm doing, well, fantastic. fantastically. Of course, I'm a Canadian, so really, in a sense, it doesn't matter what happens to you guys. I still have health care. But that was a great night last night, Seth. We like socialism here. We don't like being broke because we don't have health care. So it was a great night. Listen, just before I go on to say what I wanted to say, I wanted to tell you that adding Mike to the show has been a great addition. Your two guys in the studio with you are great, and every time Matt laughs, it totally breaks me up.
All right, well, there you go. Matt's laugh is we're gonna, if we ever get an app, we'll put it on a soundboard, maybe.
Well, you should. I love Matt's laugh. And listen, just before I go on last thing, big shout out to Jermo. I love it when he phones in. He's what a great guy. He's sure a huge fan of yours. Anyway, listen, we've talked about a lot of different things today, and I don't recall you talking about this. What do you think is the future for Karl Rove? And by the way, I have to say that I just loved watching that SOB squirming like a fish out of water yesterday on the bottom of somebody's boat. That was just,
yes,
that was just a
it was enjoyable
in light.
It was enjoyable. All right, well, let me let you go, Art, and I'm going to answer because we don't have much time, but I appreciate you calling.
All right, all the best to you, Sam. Thanks again.
All right. I think Karl Rove is going to do just like what I saw those radio guys do at Air America. They'll just find the next sucker. There's always going to be a next sucker. Because Karl Rove already has. I remember going in the day that Break Room Live got canceled. And the guy didn't want to tell me. Bennett Zier. He always hated that show. And I had tried to get them to buy me out of my contract months earlier. They wouldn't do it. I don't know why. So I just basically sat in and just collected paychecks, which would have been fine, except for it prevented me from getting other jobs. But be that as it may, he brought the producer down, told him. He brought Marin down. And the producer came back and said, Marin, go in there. He wants to talk to you. Marin came back, and I said, does he want to see me? And he said, no. And I said, oh, okay. So I got up, and I walked down the hall, and I said, well, I knocked on his door, and I said, Mark says you want to see me. And he said, come in. And he was telling me that the show was canceled. And we got into a little bit of argument about his leadership at Air America. And I said, he said, you know, there were five decisions. And he held up his hand, five decisions that were made before I got here that made it impossible for me to do my job. And he had been there for a year. And this guy had been practicing what he was going to say, how he was going to rationalize this failure. And there is no doubt in my mind that the past month, 2 months, 3 months, Karl Rove has been practicing that speech, rationalizing his failure to the next sucker. And so he will have a very well-polished speech. So what I say is, live long and prosper, Karl Rove, and may you prosper by sucking the money out of the repulsive billionaires that you have sucked money out of in the past. I hope you continue on. I wish you greater success in being able to relieve them of their money. I hope you become a wonderfully wealthy guy so you can sit in your, and he of course already is, so you can sit in your mansion and attempt to keep purchasing things and doing things to run from the horribleness that's inside of you. So good luck with that.
Zing.
There you go. Ba-boom. G. Beard, congratulations on your accurate prediction all the way through, from Romney being the Republican nominee to Obama beating him. As a Brit, I'm rather relieved at the result. Nice one. I'm happy now. I was 28 when Prop 13 was passed in Cali when I lived. My mom worked very hard to defeat it and herald it as the end of California's status as the best state for education. Everything downhill from there. I'm very happy today. Now we have to get more involved in making Obama act on issues where his positions are hawkish and corporatist. I love you, Sam. Well, thank you. Happy now. I paid $152 per quarter at Cal State. Got a great education in the early 70s. Wow. Trouble right here in River City. David Hill. Sam, don't forget Alan Grayson, who won in my district in Florida to Congress. Yes, very exciting. A defeatocrat, a conservative friend here at the office, contends that Romney's problem was not demographics, not policy, but simply that he was a weak candidate. Of course, I think he's completely wrong, but it's almost entirely demographics and policy. How would you respond to this misguided position? Indeed, he was a weak candidate. Every one of the Republicans is a weak candidate. The Republicans cannot put up a candidate who is not weak definitionally if they want to run in this country for president. Also, accepting for argument's sake that Kerry indeed lost, then how were Kerry's shortcomings different than Romney's? In other words, if Romney's problem was policy, then how does one simultaneously contend that Kerry's was not policy? I think Kerry's biggest problem was his vote for the Iraq War, because it took one of the biggest policy issues off the table. And, you know, what was the policy that he was running on? You know, he was trying to run as a vet, which I think would have been more successful had he actually had a reason to run as a vet. Because if he wasn't going, you know, his vote for the Iraq War, I think, is what doomed him, frankly. And I will also say, at that time, gay marriage, marriage equality was put on the ballot in about 6 to 8 states, which I think really hurt him. And I do believe that Ohio should have swung in his favor. Clower, would consider Chris Murphy taking Lieberman's old seat a Dem pickup in the Senate? Pretty close, yes. Lucia, very happy to see Warren win, but now I'm worried that John Kerry will leave to become Secretary of State, and then Scott Brown will easily win his seat. I think Joe Sestak would be an excellent choice for Secretary of State instead. I hope he's considered. I don't think that's an illegitimate concern, frankly, because I don't know who runs for that seat in Massachusetts. Barney Frank? I don't know.
Duvall might do it, possibly.
Interesting. For those who may not remember, Joe Sestak is a retired Navy Admiral and former representative for PA 7th District. He almost beat, in Pennsylvania, Toomey. He's a proud Democrat, spoken out against, but it was, you know, it was that wave election. Spoken out against the military-industrial complex. If he was appointed Secretary of State, would keep us out of wars instead of dragging us in them. We'll see. Crystal Count, I've always assumed those Fox folks and friends actually believe their fantasy land BS, happily lying for Murdoch's money and Ailes' mission. Today, I'm not so sure. Read Demographic Tides. It was news to me that it was only 92 that California turned blue. Prior to Clinton, it had been perma-red, but for the Goldwater blowout, not even for Kennedy. So which swing state's the next to go California perma-blue? Florida, Texas. Texas is purple in 16. Florida, I bet, is close. Wisconsin, I think, is there. Ohio, maybe. It looks like the electoral map is getting super ugly for Republicans, indeed. Oops, I meant that. Until now, I assume Foxies do not believe their BS. Owen Janine was brilliant yesterday, too. Into architecture, Prop 37 was badly written, proposition written by a lawyer who stood to get rich off of suing food companies that didn't comply fully with every letter of the law. It would have raised food prices and would have supported the pseudoscience that GMOs cause harm. I was happy to help defeat it. Bartleby, Sam, excellent list from The Atlantic on how pundits fared prediction-wise. I will check it out. And Bush and Chains will give you one last IM of the day. Alan Wist was kicked out of the Army for violently abusing Iraqi civilian. Now he has been kicked out of Congress. Hasn't conceded yet, though. Joe the Plumber loses his bid for Congress in Ohio to Marcy Kaptur. And George Bush accidentally votes for Obama. That is a hoax. The last one. Sorry, buddy. Okay, folks, until tomorrow, see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you.
get some.